at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA. Be a part of the conversation. Text us at 580-580. Please include your name and where you're texting from.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us. Lots to talk about between now and noon. We're going to go stateside. Joe Biden's team, they're ready to concede that they're not going to hit the July 4th COVID vaccination goal. Meanwhile, here in Canada, things are going well. So well, we could see stage two happen earlier than July 1st. More on that in a second. Also ahead, golden retrievers find their forever homes after an international rescue flight. You're going to get all warm and fuzzy coming up. But first,
Ottawa at Work, big five stories.
Yeah, we're counting them down, Ottawa. Speaking of getting all warm and fuzzy, John Krupe from the CTV newsroom is with us. Good morning, sir.
Free Britney.
You have a line for everything, and it's a pop culture line, no less. Yeah, she apparently is going to try and get her conservatorship removed today, right?
Yeah, she's going to speak for the first time about it.
Yeah.
Quite a long time, in years.
Since 2008. Sad that I know that. But yeah, her dad's been running her finances.
Her affairs,
since,
yeah.
Yeah, it's not
big
fair.
Story in the States. One of the big stories, one of the cultural stories, as you mentioned.
Absolutely. Also with us, the producer of the show, Matt Gitte. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
I put the the accent in there, Matt Gitte, with an E, accent aigu at the end. All right, let's talk about what's happening just across the river come Monday. They're going green. As the premier said, we're going from small parties to medium parties. I got to love it when the premier of Quebec uses these expressions. And somebody reminded me, well, we have a premier who does something a little folksy as well. But bottom line, bigger parties are happening. This is what's happening on the green level. Gatherings will increase to 10 people indoors, 20 people outdoors. No masks required indoors. How's that even a thought at this point? Maybe we need to look a little closer, Ontario. Hey, restaurants, 10 people can be seated together, and we're talking inside, 20 people on the patio. Capacity for outdoor sports moves up to 50 players and 50 spectators. And as of this Friday, outdoor festivals across the province of Quebec can also be held, and we're talking about 3,500 people allowed to go to those festivals. Meanwhile, we're being told by Dr. Williams on this side, we may get lucky and go into stage two before the July 2nd deadline. We had 8 cases here in the city of Ottawa. Is it time we follow Quebec's lead ASAP, Krupe?
Well, you call it cautious, right? This is Canada cautious and Ontario cautious even more. And do you not get the feeling that Legault and his medical officer of health, you feel more confidence in what they do compared to, say, Ontario?
Yeah, more and more. Yeah, they roll.
Yeah,
but
more
they,
and more.
Remember, they were first to roll the dice, and everybody was like, oh, let's watch what happens in Quebec. And so far, they're winning the jackpot every time.
Yeah, they've been confident in pretty much every move they've made, including some moves that we criticized pretty heavily at the time. But, if their confidence was going to lead them astray, I think it would have happened by now. But they seem to have really lucked out and not had any major stumbling blocks. It makes me wonder if maybe they're on the right track and we're not.
So why aren't we? Why aren't we, Krupe? What's going on here? You talked about Ontario caution, but it's got to be more than that.
I think it's at all costs avoid a fourth wave. Clamp down as much as you can. And we're at stage three, aren't we? We're at step three numbers.
Yeah, we are.
Yep.
That's what everybody keeps saying. Those people who've been locked down, you know, counting on the metrics to reopen are saying we are 2 steps ahead of where we would be.
I for people who are employed and, have a steady paycheck, that's one thing. You know, they can wait maybe another week or two, but you got to feel for these. Like, we had Cozy Coverings on the other day. That store, family-owned store in the Westgate Shopping Center, the mall, they can't even, you know, they can't sell out of that store because they don't have a street entrance. It's so unfair, and you got to feel for them. And if this is what's happening, and you stretch it out, so we need the light at the end of the tunnel, but right now it's the train's not coming at all.
The person who cuts my hair had a shop here in Ottawa on Bank Street. His son had one in Gatineau. Guess what? He closed his Bank Street shop, and he's over in Gatineau now because for weeks and weeks now, that's where I've gone because I live there. I could go over there and cut my hair.
The problem is that it seems like Ontario is making a lot of these plans, and the federal government as well, making a lot of these plans with the worst case scenario in mind, which makes sense. It's a pandemic. A lot of people lost their lives. Things were really bad for a long time. Quebec has more of a best case scenario outlook, And at this point with vaccines, it seems like they're betting on the right horse. We are too cautious at this point.
Yeah, and remember, they had the schools open. They closed them for a short period of time. Mm-hmm. And they also had, hate to bring it up, golf all the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was the misstep. But good thing we have Dr. Teresa Tam at the top, because she is very clear, or is she? Here's the guidance attempt for anyone with a second dose. Try and make
sense.
So
I'm sure you've heard that vaccinated people can get infected. So even the most effective vaccines are not absolutely perfect, and that it is really important for people to protect each other as well. Many people who have had full doses of vaccine are some of our most higher risk peoples, our seniors and other high risk populations that may be the ones who, even after vaccination, it would be important for them to also be protected by the protection that the community around them affords. And so that is really important. But
okay, you get the point here, right? She goes on and isn't very clear other than status quo.
The question they asked her was, why don't you give any guidance for people with two doses? A very simple question.
Yeah.
Her answer was like 2 to 3 minutes long, and it continued, as you heard, like that. And she never ended up answering the basic question of, a lot of people have two doses. What do you think they can do now? And there's just no answer in Canada. I mean, lots of people I know have had two doses now. There is zero guidance on what that even means for them.
Messaging failure, to say the least, Groupie.
Well, it's like she's reading an owner's manual of your car.
Yes. Oh, I love that. Right? And actually, it's the other person in the driver's seat who's reading it to you, and you're looking at them.
Yeah.
And like, they look at you like you're dumb because you don't understand it.
I mean, she goes by the book, and yes, we have the two-dose summer for many of us. What, we're at 25% now in Ontario? Uh-huh. But, don't hold your breath for any guidance, because – well, there you go again. Let's go back to Quebec. What are they saying? Next mm-hmm. week, you don't have to wear masks in private gatherings. You could look at
10.
The soccer, the festivals.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're taking the lead. But in Ontario, you know, Doug Ford, he's not going to do it early.
We already know that. I don't see the point of a two-dose summer if I can't get a haircut or go to the mall in this province, but I can go to a music festival in Quebec.
Oh, go to Alberta and leave your mask at home, right?
To the Stampede I go.
Yeah, as of July 1st, it's basically like there's no pandemic whatsoever. Now, the question I have, is that too risky? Are we all going to be watching closely and then hope that Alberta's right?
If Alberta had Quebec's vaccination numbers, maybe. But Alberta does not have their vaccination numbers. They are way behind.
Highest level of hesitancy there as well.
Yeah. That is the main difference. Quebec is vaccine crazy. Everyone's getting if they can. Alberta is not the case.
Vaccine crazy. Did you see those pictures last night from that sports bar in Montreal? That's a medium party.
It's a medium party for Quebec standards. That is probably a small party, to be honest.
Yeah, you're right.
But Simmer and I were teasing about this on CTV Morning Live. It's like they know how to party in Quebec, even if it's a medium party or a small party.
Just wait till next Habs game,
but,
and when they win,
which is tomorrow night.
Jean-Baptiste Day, right?
Exactly. It's Fête Nationale. I mean, it's a storybook ending to the latest series. That being said, Dr. Arruda, their equivalent of Dr. Williams, pointed out not one case of spread COVID as a result of the playoff gatherings. I mean, this is only in Quebec would they say that. They literally said these parties are going off and no one's getting sick because of it.
And just remember what Lisa McLeod said, just two, three weeks ago. Fans in the stands in August was ambitious.
Yeah. Well, you know what? She has said, well, every time I ask her, she's got to get sign off from Dr. Williams, soon to be Dr. Moore, of course. Mm-hmm. I think that he takes over officially next week. We may see a change in hesitancy there in terms of, you know, or maybe caution is a better word to describe it. I think that's when we're going to see a major shift. And that's why I think we're going to be fast-tracked into stage 2 and 3. And this will be water under the bridge.
All right.
That was a pun. That was a pun.
The dead silence.
The bridge. The bridge to Quebec. Get it? All right, I'll try harder.
The zip line to Quebec.
Yeah. Hey, are you good? Have you seen it? Tyler was on there yesterday. It looked like a lot of fun.
Not a chance, my friend.
Why?
Really?
Oh, come
really?
On.
I'm a little old for that, buddy.
No, there's no age restriction. It's only size.
Leslie, you're not going on that, are you?
In a minute, Rosie's going to do it. Wouldn't you? Come on, Croupy. I'll challenge you. You know, you can go down
tandem.
No? Okay. All right. It's
get
nine.
My hook card out if I had to do that.
It's 9:17 coming up. Why did 63 conservative MPs oppose the ban on conversion therapy? What does it say about that party in 2021? We'll discuss that on the other side. News Talk 580, CFRA.
Ottawa at Work, Big Five Stories.
We're back counting them down, Ottawa. John Croupy and Matt Gitte along with Leslie Roberts. Let's talk about what happened yesterday in Parliament. The bill banning conversion therapy, it finally passed. It's heading to the Senate. However, this is the part that jumps out a lot of people. 63 MPs opposed it. All are conservative MPs, except for one, who's a former conservative MP. More than half of the Conservative Party of Canada's caucus. What's going on here, Croupy? What does this tell you?
So much for the big tent.
Right.
And so much for the big tent and so much for being the modern party of Canada. Forget that. That's astonishingly high number. You know, maybe two or three you could explain with, you know, dinosaurs in the party, but this 63, how is the leader going to explain this? How is he going to go out and explain this when tens of thousands of Canadians are subjected to this practice? Scott Reed, the local MP, Kingston, part of the Kingston riding, said he sent out a referendum, right? And he's conservative, and he sent out a referendum, and I'm just quoting here, and it says, what here? 3,652 votes, and 69% voted yes for him to vote in favor of the parliamentary bill.
And did he?
He did.
Okay, so he did what he's supposed to do, represent the will of constituents. Mm-hmm.
So you wonder if all the others did the same thing, how many constituents would say yes, vote in favor of it? I wonder.
I doubt there are a lot of ridings where you'd get a majority of people voting against this, but obviously, conversion therapy is horrific practice. I'm going to put aside that element of it and just look at purely as a politics thing. How does the leader of this party allow this to happen with an election on the horizon? Aaron O'Toole must know that this is just ammunition for an election.
It won't affect much of the base. They're still going to vote conservative. In fact, I know there are a lot of conservative voters who will look at this and say, well, I still support same-sex marriage. It actually passed, so what are we concerned about here? So I'd like to hear from you. I want you to text in at 580-580. If you're a conservative voter and you're going to vote conservative, even though your MP, like mine, Pierre Poilievre, is voted against this ban, what is that? How do you explain it? Look, I got a vested interest here, right? Because I'm gay. I can make the case very easily. And there's a text here that kind of, I think, summarizes how a lot of people feel. And I want to take it on. That 63 conservative MPs voted against yesterday's bill is a sign of a healthy government. Not everyone in Canada agrees with the bill in its entirety. And it would be wrong for elected officials who represent all Canadians to vote in favor just because it's politically expedient. If it were any other minority group, if you said, we're going to convert the Jews, we're going to try and convert the black community, what do you think those 63 conservatives would do? They would reject it in a second. Why is it okay for these 63 conservative MPs, and I'm saying this to all the conservative voters, to try and change the gay community? How do you, trust me, I did not choose this. This is not an issue where I can be converted. You think I would really want to make my life harder?
This bill has been, this is not the first time that they voted on this. It's the closest it's gotten to be passed. At this point, I don't think any MP can argue that they don't know the details, that they don't understand the issue. They've discussed it, they've debated it, they've argued it for months and months over the years.
Croupy?
Well, then they use the cover that, you know, there's a trap in there politically. And, of course, they just don't want to deal with the issue head on. You had Ian Mendez, just 2 days ago to talk about that football player, right?
Yes.
And how he said just 6 years ago that that was unheard of. And look at the progress. So why doesn't this party, you know, read the room, read the world?
And I'm going to call out the gay candidates for the Conservative Party and the gay Conservative MP. Who's just down the road, stand up. Don't just take on the Liberals because of the blood bank issue. Stand up to your leader. Stand up to your MPs. Tell them your truth, that it isn't something that is a choice or not. And to your point, Croupy, there was Mendez who speaks so well, and I gave him huge kudos because he has influence. The sports world is a tough one. It's one of the last bastions in this fight for equality. And good on him. And it made me feel really great that he took that stand about, you know, diversity and inclusion. And there's an article that came out about there's some kid in a small town America who, after that player came out, is going to be able to live a great life. Now I'm thinking about the teenager in small town Canada whose parents are saying, yes, see, I told you. My MP says it's wrong. You're wrong, son. You're wrong. We're going to try and change you. Really, Canada? Can you live with that? John Krupe, thank you, sir. Matt Gitte, sticking around. It's coming up to 9:30. You too. We're going to break for news. News Talk 580 CFRA. Right now, I want to talk about opening. In Quebec, you know they're going green next week. You'll be able to gather inside with 10 people and not even wear a mask. We look at the numbers here in Ottawa. We're at 8 yesterday. In a city of a million, that number is so small. And we're told those numbers are never going to go away in the short term. And we aren't necessarily even in stage two yet. It's really a tale of two different provinces separated by a river. Let's get some insight from Dr. Colin Furness, infection control epidemiologist and assistant prof at the U of T. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let me ask you, when we have 8 cases here in Ottawa, I mean, we can easily make a case that we should be, if not in stage two, stage three at this point, shouldn't we? We need all the metrics.
Yes and no. Look, this is really great news that the case counts are this low. A couple things to remember. Number one is those are the reported cases. There's got to be a lot more cases out there that haven't been diagnosed, asymptomatic cases. And typically in Ontario, it seems to be about a factor of 4. So 8 is really 32. Still a low number, but still. The other thing, of course, is as travel restrictions are lifted, we're going to be importing cases. There's no question. Our border controls are not great. We're dismantling some of that now. We may have people coming in who have documentation saying that they're vaccinated and they're not. So we're going to see that a little bit. The question is whether it's going to get out of control at all or if there's going to be any outbreaks at all before we get our vaccination rates even higher. It's a tight race. I feel optimistic, but I think it would be a huge mistake to say we're out of danger.
Okay. Is it all about getting that second shot over herd immunity numbers before we can exhale completely?
I would say that's exactly it.
Okay.
The so-called Delta variant doesn't seem to much care if you've had one dose. That only provides about 33% protection, which is not very good. And so you really do want to have both doses. So in Ontario, we now have 80% of the population's had one dose, but only about 20% have had two. Now, that's going to change fast. By my count, in a month, we might be able to, at current rates, we might be able to get 80% of the population with two doses, excepting kids, of course. And that's yet another issue. We have to think about that. Kids are going to go to school in the fall.
Yep.
They're not under 12. They're not going to be vaccinated. And that's a huge risk. So keeping those numbers low is really important.
Did you see that study out of Vancouver about schools and the risk really is low?
That study out of Vancouver is problematic. It really has to do with the fact that our measurement has been really poor.
Huh.
Vancouver's their strategy has been to ascribe new cases to the community and not to schools. So if you get sick on a school bus, that doesn't count.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't think that's actually playing fair. So I think they were trying to prove a point that schools were safe as opposed to trying to ask the question, are schools safe?
Oh.
So it's difficult with kids.
So it was almost biased going into it here. We need to take it with a grain of salt.
I think it was more than biased. I think it was deceptive.
Okay. Well said. Alberta, as you know, July 1st, it's all over for them. Are they going to ruin it for the rest of the country potentially here?
They are playing a very risky game, and it feels like a boom and bust mentality applied to COVID. I'd like to be optimistic and say that they're going to be able to contain that. Their track record hasn't been great, and the big problem, of course, is open travel between different provinces means that, yes, we might be. When I talked about importing cases, I was talking about internationally, but, yeah, there's other places in Canada where cases can come from as well, and unfortunately, Alberta may be one of them. I believe Calgary has said it's not playing along those rules. It's not opening wide for July 1st because they have concerns, and I think that's a good idea.
Is this politics being played out there because Kenny's doing so poorly in the polls because of the way he has responded and given that let's face it, the Alberta population is different in terms of how they feel about the pandemic restrictions and it seems the rest of Canada does?
Alberta does seem to resemble the states sometimes. Is my impression.
Yeah.
Is the opening is a political thing? Well, probably. I mean, to some extent, COVID is and politics are not separable. Every politician wants to be able to make positive announcements. Every politician wants to be able to convey good news. And I think there's no exception there. However, if they are jumping the gun and it feels maybe like they are, it's going to backfire. And so that's a big risk Mr. Kenney is taking.
Let's go to the East Coast. Is the Atlantic bubble the example that works for you?
I've been so impressed by how they've been able to manage this that, you know, we've all been laboring under the same federal government, the same border controls, and yet the Atlantic provinces have managed this really well, not because they said they wanted zero COVID, but because that's just what they accomplished just by being really competent. And keeping a lid on travel, I think, was probably the linchpin for them. That was the most important piece. They're starting to open it up now, right? So now you can come into the bubble without vaccination and quarantine, or with vaccination and not quarantine. They're starting to play a risky game too. And I hope that we're not saying by the end of the summer, wow, we moved too fast and now we've got a problem. They're taking a risk, but I don't think they need advice from Ontario about how to manage this.
Yeah,
they've done a great job.
The template difference here is, of course, the density. The density, the greater the density, the greater risk of spread. And the Ontario, specifically the GTA example, proves that.
Well, there's no question, yet there are vast areas in the United States, I'm thinking of the Dakotas, that got clobbered, even though they're really rural. Mm. And they did that because they had large gatherings. There was a giant motorcycle rally last summer in that part of the United States that tens of thousands came to, and then they all went back to their small towns and seeded COVID. So it's not impossible. In other words, had the Atlantic provinces been reckless, I think they would have had some pretty awful outcomes. So yes, they've got protective factors, no question, but they also managed it really well.
We haven't talked about BC. What kind of a rating are you giving them for the way they've been handling this?
I think, you know, it really depends on who you talk to out there. On one hand, they've been playing a very risky game. On the other hand, they haven't had a catastrophe, but I think there's been a huge communications and trust problem there now.
Yeah.
And when I alluded to the problem that I think that their measurement of school safety has been deceptive, I use that word carefully. I think they've actually been gaming numbers, and I think they've been trying to project that, hey, we can live with COVID like Sweden learned to live with COVID. Well, the Swedish example turns out to be a terrible example.
Yeah.
And I think although BC's numbers overall actually look pretty good, I suspect they would have been better had they been a little bit more careful in how they managed it.
Science is going to take a hit, specifically scientists. We keep saying, trust the science. And then we see that when decisions are made based on science, according to the politicians, maybe they're twisting the truth a little when they say that, but that they will say that, you know, a lot of people are now feeling that science let us down because we keep having to reopen, close. You worry long term about science and trust?
Well, I think there was doubts among many about the usefulness of science starting from the beginning, and I don't actually think that's particularly new.
Mm.
This may have aggravated it a little bit, and certainly colleagues of mine have received all kinds of abuse, all kinds of threats of violence, all kinds of negativity, but really there's been a giant gap between what science recommends, and let's be clear, science gets it wrong sometimes, and science changes, right? Our understanding changes. So that's part of what science is. But the bigger problem, I think, is that the translation from science to policy through the politicians has been really problematic. No scientist wanted Ontario to be locked down for months on end. That was never the plan. The plan was to do a lockdown properly for a short period of time and to make smart rules, to be very selective about what to allow and what not to allow. And none of that was done in Ontario. So the outcomes that we've had have been really awful. But I honestly, I've got to, and maybe because I'm on the science side,
yeah,
I've got to lay it at the foot of Dr. Williams and Mr. Ford. Dr. Williams being a scientist who's been acting like a politician, and Mr. Ford, who I don't think understands public health at all. And when you have politicians who don't understand and are trying to make decisions that they think people will like, then you have bad outcomes, and I think that's what we got.
I don't know if you know Dr. Kieran Moore, but he's replacing Dr. Williams, of course. You have more faith in his decision-making capabilities?
I don't know him personally, but I know his work. And he understands communicable disease. He understands disease surveillance. He was doing innovative, really innovative disease surveillance work in Kingston like a dozen years ago. I have enormous faith and huge optimism that he is actually going to be able to accomplish what we haven't done in 15 months of pandemic in Ontario, which is smart decision-making. I'm very optimistic.
Do you think that smart decision-making means slow and steady, the way it now works in terms of stage two on the 2nd of July, 21 days later, stage three, or even more conservative than that?
Well, I think the timing is part of it, and I don't know if he's going to have an appetite to slow opening down or if that's necessarily what's important. What's going to be important, I think, is toward the end of the summer, the Delta variant is going to rise. What do we do about it?
Yeah.
What smart decisions do we make? What are we going to do about schools, especially primary schools? Just opening them up and hoping for the best is a bad idea.
Yeah.
So I think it's what happens in September that's going to really test his ability to change the course.
Always appreciate your insight and perspective, Dr. Furness. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Dr. Colin Furness, infection control epidemiologist and assistant professor at the University of Toronto.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA. Be a part of the conversation. Text us at 580-580. Please include your name and where you're texting from.
Hey, single game betting. Why do we need it is the question this morning, because it's about to pass by summer here in this country. Currently, though, criminal code bans wagering on a single sports event, which means that basically you have to bet on multiple events at once because of concerns about, well, the black market. It's underground. There's a lot of lost money here. So they're saying this is actually a win-win. Pardon the pun. But the win-win meaning that the money that is underground will now be not underground, and leagues can take advantage of this. Municipalities, provinces. I mean, there's a lot of money we're talking about here. And it better that goes into the coffers than it goes into the underground. No? Let's find out. Moshe Lander is an economist with Concordia University and actually specializes in studying the economics of professional sports. Good morning. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, I'll be with you in a second. Vegas minus one.
You got to stick with the Canadian team here if you're going to do this joke. Soon you'll be able to. So, I mean, it's single game betting. Can you, in layman's term, explain how that things would change now?
Sure. So right now, if you want to bet on a game, you have to do it through mostly what's a government-sponsored betting system where you have to bet on at least two games to go your way in order to win your bet. So that's called a parlay.
Okay.
So you can make it as exotic as you want. You can go 2, 10, 20, or whatever. The more that you take on, the bigger the payoff is going to be, but the more risk that if one thing goes wrong, you lose your money. What they're going to now is, why do you have to why do you have to bet on at least two consecutive games? Why can't you just bet on tomorrow night's game and that's it? And so that's the legislation that they just passed. And so coming this summer, we're going to be able to bet on one game at a time rather than at least two consecutive games that have to go right.
So why wasn't single game betting allowed until now? I still haven't figured that part out.
Me neither. I think that probably most of it was a morality play. The idea that somehow gambling is wrong and gambling shouldn't be that accessible. And so the idea that you can bet on any single game seems just a little bit too easy. If you have to do a two-game parlay or more, it's going to scare off maybe people that are not informed or that maybe can't afford to take on that risk. Why would you take at least two games to go your way in order to get a payoff? But I think the fact is that much like, say, gay marriage or marijuana or any of these things that we've seen come into legislation in the last decade, it's that the world has changed and what we thought to be wrong or immoral, we're kind of realizing, wait a second, that's not really correct. And so this is just one more thing where we said, why were we against it to begin with? And here it is.
I likened it to being a little bit pregnant. You're either pregnant or you're not. You either can bet or you can't. And it just didn't seem to make sense to me. Now, I'm going to play the morale game here. What about the gambling addict? Will this not lead to more issues in those who have a disease?
Yes, and that's exactly a concern that we should all be paying attention to. But the thing is that the people who were, say, addicted or the people who were least able to afford to lose their gamble, they were gambling anyway, but they were gambling offshore,
yeah,
or they were gambling off websites that weren't trackable or viewable. And so being able to provide them with the social support that was needed to help with their addiction isn't available because we just couldn't find them. Now that it's above board, the fact is that this should make it a little bit easier to provide support. It's now out in the open. So, you know, you can provide a disclaimer that says, if you're going to bet, here's a 1-800 number if you need help, or if you know somebody who's showing signs of gambling addiction, here's the thing to watch for. Please reach out to us. And so it actually should address the problem easier than keeping it illegal and underground.
Yeah, but when you put a 1-800 number up there, the person who's got the disease, do you think really going to inspire them to pick up the phone? Wouldn't it be the same people who tell them you got a problem and he's in denial anyway?
It is, but if they have a problem, they have a problem.
Yeah.
So whether they're doing it off some website that's based in the Caribbean
right.
or whether they're doing it through something that's government-sponsored, look, their problem is their problem, and they're going to need help. But it's the same sort of idea that, you know, if you have a drug problem, you have a drug problem. Now adding to it that you have to get your drug fix on the black market is just making that much more difficult to treat and deal with.
Well, except it's like the pot stores. The government wanted a piece of the action. Now they want a piece of the single game betting because there's a commission here, right?
Absolutely. And so that's the, you know, that's the financial play is that when you're running deficits of $350 billion and you realize that, wait a second, there's about $5 billion that's going on in the illegal gambling offshore. If you can repatriate that $5 billion and tax it, well, all right, it's not going to eliminate a $350 billion deficit. But hey, every billion dollars counts. And so I think that, you know, morality schmorality, there's money at play here and let's get some.
What about the leagues? Are they going to see money as a result too?
You know, when you have the Vegas Raiders, the Vegas Knights, Vegas is probably going to get an NBA team and a Major League Baseball team. And, you know, everybody is dealing with DraftKings through their podcasts and through their sponsorship deals. I think the leagues have kind of gotten over this. In fact, the CFL should be salivating now because they're going to be able to now start getting in on the game. And while it's maybe not going to turn into NFL-style volumetric betting, the fact is that that's a league that desperately needs every fan that they can get. And if they can offer you stamps minus five, then they're going to be very happy with this.
Yeah, and that's the plus side. I mean, we want to support Canadian, and CFL is huge. They, of course, count so much on receipts at the gate. But they won't get any of the commission. They'll just get more viewers, potentially, to game day and so on, right, on TV.
Yeah, and you know, the future, and it's not that far out, is that you're very easily going to imagine that you and I are going out to an Alouettes game, and, you know, you're going to get up and you're going to say, hey, Lander, you want anything? I'm going to say, here's $5, grabbing a hot dog, and also put down a couple of bucks on the stamps in the second half.
Mm.
We're going to see that betting is going to creep into the arena, into the stadium, where it's going to be a concession stand that you can just place a bet, and that's going to be the way to overcome that. Nobody wants to go to games anymore when you've got 5G and the ability to control the camera on your own from your couch.
It's like going to the racetrack.
Exactly, and that's exactly why the idea of the morality thing makes sense. You can go bet on a single race, and within 10 races, you can put something down on the fifth. Why can't you put something down on the third quarter over-under in a Raptors game?
Any limits and in terms of an amount of betting? Again, I'm playing the morality card here, but could you do your whole paycheck on it?
Well, I mean, at least at the beginning, they're not going to have any way to be able to supervise that, right? So, you know, even if you want to put some sort of limitation on it, fine. Then I just find somebody who has a higher income than me and I say, you bet on my behalf and I'll share my winnings with you.
Yeah, it's like sharing someone's ID to get a bottle of wine at this LCBO. It's done all the time.
So that type of thing, that's going to be really hard to kind of control. And it's probably something that they don't want to do. So I think that to cover their backside, it's going to be trying to provide those social supports and ways to try and make that very visible, at least in the beginning, to make sure that, you know, the morality police are not going to be out in full force. And once they show that, you know what, it's not really changing behavior too much, except for maybe at the margin, I think people will relax about it. It's the unknown that's causing the anxiety this morning.
Can we expect that the underground, that was the place to go in the past when it came to single game betting, would now give you better odds and therefore try and undercut this legal aspect?
I would say that go take a look at the skyline of Vegas, and you can see that they're not running it as a charity. They're not, you know, it's a cutthroat competitive business.
Yeah.
But the thing is that all of those casinos are basically offering the same basic odds because they're looking at the same data.
Yeah.
And so they're not in it to try and undercut the competitor. They're in it to make a guaranteed profit. And so the odds that they're going to offer is not going to be fundamentally different, whether it's above board or underground. And that's maybe the reason why people will feel a little more comfortable that, you know, as long as they realize that it's not going to change their fundamental betting that much, then you may as well go above board than keeping it underground where there's no consumer protection.
I know some critics were saying, oh, this could lead to game fixing. That's not a real concern, is it, in 2021?
Yeah, in the 1950s, maybe.
Yeah.
But no, the game fixing is that's most likely to happen at low-level leagues where there's not a lot of volume betting to begin with, right? So, you know, are we worried that we're going to see the NHL or the NFL? I mean, Tim Donaghy is maybe a name that will resonate with NBA fans where there was a ref that was maybe accused of match fixing. But the fact is that the league is working very closely with these casinos and they're looking at that same tremendous volume of data. And if they see it, that would be the death knell for their sport. If you believed for one second that a hockey game was fixed, you'd never be able to watch hockey again because we've now drifted from hockey into professional wrestling, where while the action is real, the ending is predetermined, and that completely spoils the point of watching sports. So, the sports themselves work very vigilantly with the leagues to make sure that if there's the tiniest whiff of something going on, they will jump all over it right away to eliminate it and prosecute it.
Remember when Pete Rose bet against the Reds back in the day?
We're reminded of that every year when the Hall of Fame comes up, right?
Yeah. Poor guy. Yeah, but I mean, that kind of, could that happen here?
It could, but again, it's what are the stakes, right? So, you know, the Pete Rose example is telling, right? Because what was Pete Rose's salary back in the 1970s or when he was managing in the 1980s, right? He was earning a couple hundred grand. I mean, it's nothing to sneeze at. But when today's players are earning $30 million in guaranteed money, what do they care about fixing some, you know, missed free throw at the end of a game, right? Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons' problems are Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons' problems, not that there's some Vegas gangster standing behind them saying, I'll give you an extra mil if you miss the shot. They're making $30 million. $1 million is nothing to sneeze at, but to them it's not worth the lost reputation and that lost money.
Okay, appreciate. You got great perspective and insight as always. Thanks for clearing it up for us.
Anytime.
Moshe Lander, economist at Concordia University in Montreal, and his specialty is the economics of professional sports. 10:16. Okay, what do you think? Is this something that you would take advantage of? There is a downside, unfortunately, to single game betting. Is this something that you take part in now in terms of partay, in other words, several? Tell me what you think of this change. Is it a big deal? I mean, they're saying they're going to be able to actually make this money legal and that society at whole can possibly profit from it. Is that something you think is true, or is this all an excuse? 580-580, text me, let me know. And you're going to hear the dark side. We just have to look across the ocean, across the pond, as they say, in the UK. We'll find out about that next. News Talk 580 CFRA.
Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Welcome back. What is the Ontario Lottery Corporation's slogan? Know your limits, play within it, right? Or them. There's concern from those in the gambling addiction world that when we open up single game betting, that there's going to be a huge increase. Now, that's based on examples around the world and also just the battle to try and contain those who are suffering from this horrible disease that destroys lives, several lives, not just the person who's gambling, of course. They lose everything in this. And it is a disease. It's an addiction. Matt Gitte, producer, used to live in the UK, and single game betting, that's pretty common there.
Oh, it's extremely common. It's everywhere. It's not just, you know, available online. It's there are stores devoted to it, bet shops that are on every street corner. They are all over the UK in a way that is, you know, in a way that you may find a Couche-Tard, you know, or a Starbucks everywhere. There it is betting shops, and they're also located inside other stores, like a betting counter. And these days, of course, they also have apps on your phone as well. It has been legal there for so long that it is completely, completely common. And because football or soccer is so popular there, betting on it is an everyday thing. It's something that people start very young, and it's something that a lot of people do throughout their lives. Mm. Some people don't do it at all. You know, it's like drinking. Some people never partake. Other people partake way, 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 way too much. And because it's so acceptable and it's so easy to get, A lot of people start before it's even legal, before they're even supposed to.
Well, and to the point that Moshe Lander was saying earlier, he was saying, look, it's already going on underground. This actually brings it up, and we could have maybe see it more clearly and therefore deal with it. The fact is, are they dealing with it in the UK?
So yes, with a big star on that, yes. You know, anytime there's kind of a vice or something like that that's more accessible, you know, they put money towards it, you know, towards addiction counseling services to get people help, of course. But imagine how, you know, you to get alcohol here, you got to go to certain stores and buy it there. Imagine if you could just pull out your phone and have a case of any alcohol you wanted delivered to your house at any time, day or night, no proof of ID or anything.
That's the betting example.
That's the betting example. Okay. It starts off protected and there's money for support, but it becomes so universally accessible that, like, it does creep into places that should.
You know, when you go to Vegas and they're apparently, if you are a problem gambler, they'll take your picture and they'll put it in for security to alert and then they'll turn you away.
Sure.
And you're supposed to go to them voluntarily and I'll do this sort of thing as your part of your, I guess, recovery.
Mm-hmm.
You live with it, of course. It's an addiction. There are lawsuits against these casinos by individuals who had their picture posted but didn't get stopped.
Oh, yeah. Here in Quebec, in Montreal, I recall the Journal de Montréal in Montreal would do many exposés where they would set up, like, stings that have someone who'd get banned, and then they would record them going in over and over and over again, and then do a big
at the Montreal casino.
At the Montreal casino, because, you know, in theory, the system is great to keep people out. But
until we have facial recognition, you know, apps or whatever, or technology, well, we kind of do, but sure. You know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Can we expect a security guard to be able to spot when they have 1,400 people, right?
Of course not. And Moshe's argument makes perfect sense. You know, it's not going to stay illegal forever. It makes sense. It's underground. There are already people whose lives are being destroyed by it. Why not bring it into light, regulate it, maybe help people out? But the only issue is that when it's legal, when it's easy to get, it does also make it seem like something that more people might try. And the more people try something.
Right. Well, it's like smoking pot, right?
Some people are going to get addicted to it.
When it was illegal, people are like, I don't want, you know. But and then the argument, of course, well, it's a drug like alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
You drink a bottle of wine or smoke a joint. What's the difference? Well, now it's legal. And so people who would never smoke a joint in the past are now doing it because it's like a bottle of wine for others.
Yeah. You know? And I mean, even in the U.S. right now, you know, there are lots of companies like DraftKings and stuff like that they are everywhere. They're in every sport. And like Moshe was saying, they sponsor every league. You know, they sponsor every game.
Yeah.
And it is a ton of fun for people who like doing it and who like doing it responsibly. Great. But gambling is not like light fun for everybody involved.
Someone has texted in. Rob from Gloucester says, I think what it allows is more fun fan betting. In the past, you would follow all of a sport to bet. But now with this, you are going to a Sens game, for example, and they always win when you are at the game, right? Okay, because you're buying a ticket. And then you can have some fun and throw a bet in as well. And that was what Moshe said. He said, look, this means that there's another reason to go to a game if you want to bet. Like you would go to a racetrack. Rito,
I actually really like that idea.
Yeah.
Because that, to me, that solves the problem, which is too accessible. If you had to go to a game to bet on a game, fine, great. You know, that to me makes perfect sense. And
it's not going to happen.
It will not happen.
No, they're going to have the access, right? You want to do it from home.
That's it. There's so much money. And, you know, maybe that money goes towards great things for the provinces, and that's great.
Yeah.
I hope that people have a lot of fun with it. I hope that people are responsible and keep an eye on your friends or
the
family
numbers.
Who are betting a lot.
Well, and some of that money should go back to the programs to help people.
It has
to. I'm sure they're writing some of that, but the question is it enough? You know, does it balance out the pros and cons? Rob goes on to say, I think it's good to get a greater involvement and create a more fun level to it, like lottery tickets, instead of having to know other teams and invest in other games at the same time to win. Yeah, and this is the thing, right? I mean, the lottery is a great example where you see people who struggle financially, but they dream of winning, in this case, $35 because there were two tickets last night in the $70 million, and then a bunch of other $46 million. One of them, by the way, was in Ontario. Mm-hmm. The other one is in BC. So check your tickets, said the man who's trying to make a case against gambling, right? Here I am. And I'm caught up in lottery fever. I can tell you.
Of course.
You know, if I'm in some gas station in the outskirts of Ottawa, they always win. They always win in a community like this. I'm buying some tickets.
My wife and I always say when there's a big lottery, we're at a gas station, we always say, you know, maybe we should. Maybe just, you know, maybe we should. Which is, of course, what everyone does. And you know what? I think it's totally fine. It's totally fun. And you know what? This could also be great for some leagues that maybe are struggling to get people to watch.
Yeah.
There's certain sports teams in Canada that maybe could use the extra viewers.
Uh-huh.
You know, gambling does make a game more fun if you aren't that invested, maybe you tune out. But if you have money on the game, you're probably going to stick around.
I wonder what proportion of people that gamble are actually problem gamblers. If that problem is getting worse over the years as the technology has improved to make it easier for you to gamble. I would assume the answer is yes. I don't have that to back me up. But it's just like any addiction. You stick a bottle of beer in front of some. I'm a child of two alcoholics, mm-hmm. so I know that story. That if it's in the house, it's going to get drunk because the disease takes over.
Yep.
It's, you know,
you can get addicted to a lot of things and it can catch you by surprise who it might affect and when. It's just one of those things that we just have to be really careful about. And I really, really, really hope that they like tap the brakes on it at least when they're starting to allow it. And it's not just like on your phone by the end of the year.
Well, and the argument is if you're going to allow lottery tickets, why aren't you allowing this? And that's the greatest argument. I can't push back, right?
That's right.
It's just that it's entry level gambling because the lottery ticket is a game of chance. You
exactly.
You buy one ticket, the odds are better. You're going to get hit by lightning, but somehow you spend that $5 or $10 because you get to dream. You get to think about what it's like to win at least a portion of that grand jackpot, right? And then you hear all those lottery stories where people lose everything in a short period of time. There was the famous one in Quebec. It was the Lavigueur family. So they were a family that all put in a dollar. It was the Olympic lottery back in the day. And it became a movie, actually. So the Lavigueurs, I think they had like seven members of the family. And I was a cub reporter at a radio station in Montreal when they won, and they held a press conference in their little apartment. It was a flat. It was a lower duplex. And we were all squished in there, the reporters, because this was, you know, a family that had put it. Except for one daughter. She didn't put in her $1, and they actually didn't give her share. She didn't get her share, and she ended up suing them. They moved to this big mansion on the water in Laval, and they used all their money up in a short period of time. And, I mean, it was a horrible ending. It was a horrible ending. Not only did they lose all their money and find themselves in a deeper hole than when they had no money, but they also broke up the family over it. It was really quite sad. And that is why the argument is, do we really want to allow gambling to the point that we do? Because we see the social consequences of that.
Yeah.
Now I'm gonna contradict myself because it's always nice to give a lottery ticket as a hostess gift when you go to someone's house. You know, for the hostess who is everything, bring a bottle of wine, but bring a lottery ticket and say, "Here's $70 million," and then they say, "I'll give you 10%." And you go, "Perfect, I'll take 7." All right, 10:30. Take a quick break. Calum's got your news. News Talk 580 CFRA.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA. Be a part of the conversation. Text us at 580-580. Please include your name and where you're texting from.
You know, as we celebrate the vaccine rollout and the numbers that continue to increase, double vaccinations now outpacing single doses. That's the good news. We've turned, of course, a huge corner. But what about the kids? Are they being left behind? Let's dig a little deeper. How seriously concerned should we be since they seem to be the last group that will be vaccinated? And we've got the summer to do it, right? Going back in the fall. Can we get that done before they get back in class? And what is the true risk? Let's bring in Emily Grunewald. She is President and CEO of Children's Healthcare Canada. Good morning. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Leslie.
Do you feel that they're an afterthought, they being kids?
I think we've seen kids be an afterthought throughout the entire pandemic, to be honest. Many of the policy decisions that we're seeing governments make haven't considered the direct and indirect impacts on children, youth, and their families. The back-to-school decisions in Ontario are a great local example mm-hmm. of where we've seen children not be the priority in our decision-making framework.
That aside, and I get it, you don't have to convince me. I know about the mental health well-being consequences. We still don't know the long-term effects of. I think most people are on side with that. But here's the question. Did we get it wrong when we decided to vaccinate the elder members of our society, seen as the most vulnerable given their health issues, before we brought the kids in? And that now, even the WHO is saying, get the adults around the world all covered before we go into the younger ones because of the risk is a lot lower.
I think it was absolutely the right decision for a couple of reasons to vaccinate our vulnerable senior population first. They are the population that we're seeing having the greatest impacts with respect to concerns for their health and hospitalization upon transmission of COVID. The other factor to consider is we didn't until very recently have a COVID vaccine that was approved, safe, and effective for children. So we did have to wait to make children eligible for vaccination. So I think the strategy to date has been appropriate.
To date. Okay. So now that we have a supply, it's not, the floodgates aren't open, but close. We're seeing that people who want the shot can, they're moving up their shots and so on. Is now the time to pivot and say, okay, let's include 12 and under, 12 and 18? How do you see this ideally go?
Sure. So Canada has a really reliable source of vaccines at this point. So we're seeing thousands, if not millions, of vaccines delivered daily.
Yeah.
And we do have children ages 12 to 17 now approved for use of the Pfizer vaccine. Across the country, we're seeing about on average 55% uptake of the vaccine amongst that population, which we got off to a fantastic start, very quick uptake in terms of youth choosing to be vaccinated, but things are slowing down. So now we need to start to think about how do we increase confidence in the vaccine? How do we increase accessible information so that parents and youth can make a well-informed decision? And even more importantly, how do we start to reach some of the vulnerable communities who are lower in terms of their vaccine rates, whether that's because they aren't able to access the vaccine or they don't have the information available to make that decision. So I think that needs to be a real focus of our efforts right now.
Okay, so informed decision, you're careful how you choose your words there when it comes to parents and their take on vaccinating kids, I'm guessing here. As CEO of Children's Healthcare Canada, you got to walk lightly because you want, obviously, to represent all kids. How do you feel about parents who are anti-vaxxers?
You know, I think it's a great opportunity to provide further information. Evidence is evolving every day, but we are very confident in vaccines in general as a very important part of a child's health and development. And the COVID vaccine is no different from that. So I think we need to think about how we're making information about the COVID vaccine accessible in different languages to different levels of education. And again, how do we get the vaccine out into the community? How do we make it accessible as possible for families who might not have the opportunity to miss work to come to a mass vaccination clinic, or who might have kids who are nervous about needle pain or have needle fears in general? So how do we make that a safe experience, and how do we make it accessible?
Would you support those who say that, like other vaccinations, measles, et cetera, that are required for kids to go to public school, we should make it mandatory as well for kids to get the COVID vaccine if they want to be in class with other kids in public school?
Yeah, mandatory is a tough word.
I know, it is. And I'm not trying to back you in a corner. I'm just saying you're not going to change an anti-vaxxer's mind right now because we've been talking about it for 15 months. So what do you do to protect the other kids and their own child, to be quite honest?
Yeah, I think, you know, the whole conversation in Canada is about how do we establish herd immunity? How do we reach a vaccination rate for the population at whole of approximately 85%? And of course, children and youth being vaccinated are almost a necessity at this point in order for us to reach those levels of safety and security and reduce transmission. So I think we do need to think about making sure our teachers are vaccinated, making sure other school educator and staff are vaccinated, making sure as many youth at this point as possible are vaccinated, and hopefully in time for a return to school this September so we see fewer disruptions in their education as in the past. I don't think making vaccines mandatory is the path forward. I don't think we've seen that be successful in a number of different fronts with adults or with children. So I would really shy away from the conversation of making a vaccine mandatory.
Fair enough. We're going to have to possibly make some tough decisions come the fall because the chances of rolling it out to 100% of all the people who want it, especially kids, and getting back in time for the return to school is going to be rough. So do we send them back anyway? Does the benefit far outweigh the risk is what I'm trying to say. Is it better we send them back even though they're not vaccinated so they don't have to face the other issues that we've seen because they've been kept out of class?
Well, hopefully our middle school kids and high school kids will be at least one dose vaccinated by September. Hopefully the majority will have their second dose by that point. And we know that the teachers and the other staff have been eligible for some time. So hopefully that will provide a degree of protection in addition to some of our other safety precautions that worked quite well, right? So masking, some degree of cohorting, the opportunity creates physical distancing. So all those tactics would still apply and certainly add to make it a safer environment. When we're talking about our primary and junior kids, they likely will not have a vaccine approved before school starts in September. We're looking at a later date, likely November, December timeline. So I do hope desperately that we will be able to get those kids back in the classroom in September for a number of, you know, physical, psychosocial, mental health reasons, and that we can do that successfully. We know that Ontario kids have been out of school for approximately 22 weeks, which is by far the longest in Canada, by far the longest in North America, and almost the longest in the world. So there is a great opportunity to return these kids to school safely in the fall with appropriate safety measures in place.
Can I say from what you said there that maybe we got it wrong here in Ontario?
Well, I think we could have done better, and I think we could have made different choices, and this gets back to the idea of making kids our priority and thinking about making schools the last place to close and the first to open.
The Trudeau government has already promised to give any leftover vaccines, and they've ordered far more than we need, of course, for everyone to get two doses, including the kids. But that decision is going to be made even sooner than we think, so it could be while we're still rolling it out. Do we need to do Canada first before we give any away, including the kids?
You know, I think we have sufficient supply in Canada to do both. I think we can still proceed with vaccinating our children, getting second doses into the arms of adults while still supporting international or global efforts. I think that's really important. So I would argue we're in a place now, a very fortunate place, that we can achieve both.
Really? Because we're not, I mean, we still haven't approved it for kids. So do we, in the meantime, give them away because they're sitting, you know, we could be helping other countries? That's going to be the ethical issue, right? Do we put faith in that they're going to deliver more when we need them once the approval is given? And in the meantime, forego the kids because it hasn't been approved and give them away?
I don't think we're foregoing the kids. The kids, 6 months to 12 years, like I said, won't be approved until likely later in the fall. And that population, 0 to 12, is approximately 6 million in Canada. So I still think with the doses that we have still forthcoming, those that we have in place to support first and second doses for youth and for adults, we're still in a place where I think we can afford to continue to contribute to the global effort.
And that's not to undersell where we are, because we're in a great spot. We just need to keep it rolling out.
Absolutely.
Emily Grunewald, President, CEO of Children's Healthcare Canada, important voice in the ongoing discussion when it comes to the COVID vaccine rollout. Thanks for your insights.
Thank you for your time.
Cheers. Take a quick break on the other side. The Biden team, we're going to have to concede, they didn't hit the July 4th COVID vaccination goal as they hoped. Can we start bragging here now? Have we surpassed the United States? Could it be? No, of course we're not going to brag. We're Canadian. But we'll go south of the border next. News Talk 580 CFRA.
They leave from work because they refused to get the COVID vaccine, any of the COVID vaccines. It wasn't like there was one in particular that was funny to them. They just didn't want to get any of them. They felt like none of them were technically approved by the FDA beyond anything emergency usage. So they didn't want to get it. And the hospital basically said, well, look, you've got till June 7th to get this vaccine, or that's going to be it for you. And now a good deal, those people, 150 of them or so, are out of work because they decided not to get the COVID vaccine. And of course, in the healthcare world, you kind of want your people in healthcare to have a vaccine, knowing full well that, you know, they're at least going to be in better shape, especially dealing with things like viruses on a daily basis. So that seemed to be kind of the expand that now across the nation. You're seeing a number of people who just don't feel like the vaccine is something that they want to get. And this 70% that Biden was looking for from the very get-go was acknowledged by pretty much everybody that this was, it may not be attainable. It was a very high goal that he was shooting for, that he was looking to try to get to that level, but it wasn't necessarily something that was achievable, if you will. So, but let's give it a shot. Let's give it a try. Let's see if we can barter, see if we can put things out there like free beer or donuts or weed or whatever it might be into the minds of Americans to say, if you get the jab and you get the vaccination, we'll be good to go, to try to get to that 70 to 75, 80% of vaccination rate that we would like to have to get to herd immunity, certainly making things safer. So at this point in time, we know that it doesn't look like you're going to meet the target. We saw Dr. Fauci say yesterday that he is of the belief that maybe a mid-July timeframe could be the earliest in which we could do that. But it does sort of seem that there's a number of things that perhaps it's the politicization of all of this gone on with masks and COVID in this country when Trump was in office. Perhaps it's just people who are anti-vaxxers, people who don't like vaccines in general, who stay away from hospitals, that maybe is a big part of the concern as well. But it does not look like we're going to hit that goal of 70%. We may be at that 65, maybe even get to like a 68%. But trying to get to that goal of 70% doesn't look like it's going to happen by July 4th.
We see the stands and the fans, as they say, you know, where NHL hockey is huge here. We see Vegas, and then they're taking on Montreal, and they've got 3,500, and it was a big deal when they went from 2,500 to 3,500 fans. They're all masked. They're socially distanced. And then in Vegas, it's a totally different story.
Yeah.
How much of this is just that America's gone back to normal life?
I think that's a big part of it. I think Americans were so desperate to get back to normal life that they're back to normal life regardless of vaccinations. I think you're seeing, you know, I'm in Texas. I'm in Austin, Texas. Yeah. And around these parts in Texas, there are, I think we're at about 40% of the entire state have been vaccinated. But you wouldn't guess it by walking around. People all over the place are acting like nothing has gone on, like nothing's wrong, like there isn't some variant out there that could possibly be a big problem by the time summer, late summer, fall roll around here. And that they feel like they're just, you know, we're good to go. Young people kind of still holding up that same argument that they had, let's call it spring break last year, 2020, when they're like, I'll go out and party with all the people at the pool and out in Vegas. And, you know, I'm immune to this. I'm young. I'm not going to get a problem with this, even though we now know, as we're starting to learn more about this virus, that, you know, having caught COVID, even if you survived it and didn't have very many symptoms, could cause brain damage down the road. So I don't know why we're so quick to take off the masks and say that everything's good when legitimately we're hearing concerns every day. And the doctors like the CDC director or Dr. Fauci indicating we could be having 3,000 deaths a day come in summer and fall, or certainly heading into the winter, if we don't do something about this with the way the variants are spreading. So it's this American belief that it's not going to happen to me. And for the people who have been, you know, the smaller number of people who have been vaccinated, there's kind of this belief, well, then they're protecting the rest of us and it should be fairly easy goings for the rest of us. And I think that's the ignorant way to go about this.
What is the population? Are you at 2 million Greater Austin?
I think that's about right. I would say it's right around that population.
So you're double the size of Ottawa. And we had 8 cases yesterday. We count them and they're on the media. They become headlines every day. When you turn on the local media, do you see how many cases there are every day in Austin?
I can't tell you the last time I saw that.
Yeah.
I can't tell you. I mean, you have to dig deep. And I would say that in Texas in general, it's a problem because I don't think they have been particularly honest in their reporting since day one. And I think that with that, I mean, you know, obviously we had surges here with a part of the Sun Belt surge with the Floridas and the Californias and the Arizonas and the like in the summertime that was really bad. And you did see a lot of concern there, certainly about the death rate, and they were having to bring in the refrigeration trucks and those kinds of things. But then since that time, it's been slim pickings to try to get honest information. Oftentimes I'll have to find myself digging in deep into Reddit and other websites where you've got health people that are working there that are posting this information, but you can't find it readily available through any of the health sites. So I think there's, you know, we've seen that with Florida. We're seeing it with Texas. The concern is not knowing that portion and just under the belief when your governor says masks are off, everything's open, 100% capacity, get out there and get back to business as usual. That's a really scary thought, realizing what's out there still and the sheer lack of people in this state in particular that have been vaccinated. In Austin, there's seemingly a pretty good amount of people, but you still get people coming in from outside of Austin into other parts of Texas that aren't vaccinated, and that's pretty frightening.
We're the last jurisdiction in Canada, Ontario is, to be under the kind of measures that we're under. I mean, we still only have outdoor patios, and it's only a certain capacity with huge measures in place. Retail, 15%. And if you're in a mall, forget it. You have to have an outdoor. I mean, you go through the list. I'm curious because we're envious of hearing your stories about what's going on. But I wonder if the flip side is you're a little nervous. You feel like you're gambling a little too much because they're not taking serious enough. Would you rather be in Ottawa where we're on super lockdown and doing it one step at a time, despite only having 8 cases in the city of a million? Or would you rather be where you are?
That's a great question. And I think for me, I try to play it as safe as I can here. I've had arguments with my wife about it. We both got literally vaccinated, both of our shots on the same day and with our same days. And with that, I still feel like I've got to wear a mask around. I don't know. I don't know who I'm running into. And it's not necessarily about the symptoms that I might get. It might be what I pass on to somebody else who I don't even know whether they've gotten their vaccine shots or not. That's my concern. And certainly then, even if I do end up catching the virus, what does that mean for diseases down the road or issues down the road?
Right.
I don't know about it yet. So I'm concerned about that. That's probably an overprotective dad element of me, but that's where I am. So it'll be funny. My family and I will go out, like we went out for Father's Day to dinner, and the entire time I'm walking to and from places outside of sitting down and eating, I have my mask on, and my wife is just going, why are you doing this?
Really?
We're vaccinated. And I'm like, I know, but I feel like there's more there that I need to be concerned about right now.
Okay, not to judge. Are you single or double vaccinated?
I am double vaccinated. Both of us are double vaccinated.
Yeah, okay.
And my 14-year-old daughter is now double vaccinated.
Really? Okay, see, we're still rolling it out to the kids. So, and again, most of us are single. We're waiting for the second, although right now the double vaccine rollout is outpacing the single, which is good news. But if you look around on Father's Day in that restaurant, how many other Michael Bowers wearing masks were there?
Not a lot. I mean, virtually nobody. When we walked in and the place was packed, the steakhouse was packed for Father's Day, there was virtually nobody in the lobby, except for employees of the restaurant. Nobody in the lobby wearing any sort of mask whatsoever. I felt like I was the only one. And I did feel like I was getting looks from people.
Yeah.
Frankly, besides my family, I felt like I was getting looks from people for wearing my mask in there. But once we sat down at the table, there was enough distance between the tables that I felt safe. But it was a situation that, you know, I would choose to go to outdoor restaurants or do outdoor shopping or be in a place where there's far less people. If I had that choice to do that, I would do that every day.
Okay. Thanks. I appreciate that. It's a good reality check for those of us up here who are wishing we could be down there and then now saying, well, maybe we don't after talking to Michael Bauer. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
You got it. Stay safe.
You too. NBC National Radio Correspondent Mike Bauer. 11 o'clock, break for news. Callum's next. News Talk 580 CFRA.
At work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA. Agree or disagree, we want to hear from you. Text us at 580-580. Please include your name and where you're texting from.
You know, as we celebrate the rollout and the speed at which people are getting not only one but two doses, there is a population that is being overlooked potentially here, at least not part of the discussion these days. That is those inside detention centers, like at the Ottawa Carleton Detention Center. 36 inmates and 5 staff members at the jail testing positive. So that's now forced a lockdown, and it's an outbreak, and yet we don't hear about it. So let's discuss it more. We're going to talk with Justin Pichet, associate professor in the Department of Criminology at the U of O. He's also a member of the Criminalization and Punishment Education Project, and he actually set up a hotline for these inmates. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you've talked to these guys on the inside. What are they telling you about how it's being handled?
Well, we started getting phone calls in late March when folks were starting to talk about vaccines inside prison walls. There were rollouts at the Milton Correctional Complex and the Toronto South Detention Center. And guys were phoning our hotline basically saying that they were concerned about taking vaccines at that time when they would eventually be offered to them for a number of different reasons. There's many reasons for vaccine hesitancy, poor experiences of healthcare owing to discrimination because of the color of their skin, poverty, or the stigma around the health issues they were seeking care for, including drug use and mental health issues. Many behind bars have been mistreated and abused in jail and don't trust what jail management and staff tell them.
Absolutely.
And
these are all valid life experiences playing out. And so now they're being told to put this foreign substance into their bodies by the very people who are holding behind bars. I can hear it. So how do we change that? I mean, what did you say to them?
Well, tried to provide them as much information as possible based on what we knew, and also trying to address concerns around underlying health conditions they have, right, and the impacts that they're concerned about if they take it. But I sent a note out to Ottawa Public Health, CC Dr. Vera Etches, on, I believe it was 26th of March, basically saying, this is what we're hearing, this is going to be an issue, and you need to do something about it or there's going to be outbreaks here. And that communication was ignored, and here's where we are a few months later.
Well, I'm looking at a June 22nd article, and it says, stopping jail outbreaks of COVID-19 needs to be a priority, according to Dr. Etches. So apparently the outbreak has ended because suddenly people have either recovered from it or, I mean, is it still an ongoing problem?
There's a few cases in there, but of course we have to consider that there's people that are being newly admitted to the jail
right.
every day, right?
Yeah.
So if we're deciding to not contain COVID, but containing people instead, the risk is going to be there. And of course there's staff going in and out of there every day and returning to their families and to their communities day in and day out. And, you know, folks are still getting their second shots and stuff like that. In the case of staff, there's vaccine hesitancy there as well, I'm sure, as there is more in the general population. And of course, prisoners, many of them haven't taken their first shots because of vaccine hesitancy. And we need to get people in there that incarcerated people will trust to provide them with the information about benefits and side effects. There's some pilot projects happening in Toronto jails around this, and
we've
recommended the same thing since the end of March.
And they're going
we
in?
We offered to go in ourselves.
Oh, you did? Because they got your trust because you set up the line. You're the communication with their concerns specifically about this, and you pay attention to their life experiences of let's face it, bigotry, really, in healthcare. I hear it all the time from friends who, especially black friends of mine, who say, I go in there, I'm going to get a different reception than you will if I walk into the ER at a hospital. And I'm like, really? And they, oh, yeah, based on the fact they're going to think I've done something with drugs or whatever it may be. And then you add the prison element to this, and it just makes it worse in terms of the way they're being treated. And number two, the hesitancy that they're going to have, right?
Yep.
So,
yeah,
so
it's complicated for sure.
So would they trust you if you went in there?
Well, if we went in there with public health professionals and gave them credible information, I think they'd trust us more than jail staff.
What's credible?
Jail management, including healthcare staff. So,
but what's credible information if it's not from public health people?
Well, people they trust, you know, like that represents the demographics that are currently behind bars, right? We know Indigenous people,
right.
Black people are mass incarcerated. In contrast to other populations, we know that people, you know, who have lived with homelessness or people who have lived with drug use or mental health issues, you know, if people can understand that, hey, here's someone who's walked a mile in my shoes, who probably shares my concerns, but is now getting the vaccine and they're telling me of the benefits of it and potential impacts, I'm going to trust that information.
Are you getting any offers on your...
No.
No, nobody's taking up on your offer.
No, I don't think the jail probably would balk at that idea.
Okay.
But, you know, there's other people in the community that would be trusted to do that by the institution and by prisoners. And we're happy to share advice on that.
Yeah, I'm trying to take the prison's position here for a second. And that is when there is a medical requirement, we make sure that the inmates get it because they obviously have some sort of a hospital scenario on the inside. Am I right?
No. So I'll just share a few
Please.
Things about healthcare at OCDC.
Please do.
During the pandemic, they didn't have a healthcare manager for 7 months. They have nursing shortage for a number of reasons. I mean, it's difficult work, obviously, but also... you know, they're not paid the same as they would be, say, if they worked in a hospital. Mm. And the benefits aren't the same. So, I mean, it's really a deplorable situation. It's actually the top complaint at the jail hotline since we started in December 2018 and have taken, I think, around 8,000 calls now. It's always been healthcare has been the top concern shared by, you know, when we look at the overall numbers of our hotline. So, you know, this is not new and the pandemic has just made things worse. And how in the midst of a pandemic, when there's COVID cases or the risk thereof, having such shortages, and there's one mental health prisoner right now. So, you know, in a context where we're coming off a COVID outbreak, where people were locked in their cells 23 and a half hours a day without access to yard, fresh air, programs, visits. Can you imagine the toll that would take on its mental health? We all know the impact that the pandemic has had on our mental health. Imagine being locked in a cage.
No, I can't.
And one mental health nurse to talk to in a facility that, I mean, it's 585 beds. Right now it holds about 400.
Okay.
It's crazy.
Capacity, over capacity. Space is even smaller because of the numbers. And then imagine being in a small space because they don't want to, they're worried about spread, what that does. No, it seems inhumane. What are these crimes these guys are serving time for?
So in our provincial system in jails like the Ottawa Carleton Detention Center, 70% of people are awaiting trial. 30% of people are serving sentences of 2 years minus a day.
Right.
Because otherwise they'd be in federal.
Federal ones.
And when you look at the majority of things that people are in for, either accused or convicted of, it is for nonviolent accusations or convictions. So a lot of what explains the number of people behind bars in Ottawa is basically poverty in a lot of cases, right? Folks that can't get access to bail or don't have adequate community support to maintain their bail conditions. Wow. So you have, for instance, a quarter of prisoners in Ontario, including here in Ottawa, cycling from homeless shelters. They're more visible, more likely to get in interactions with the police, and cycling from the homeless shelters or the streets to the jail and then vice versa. Which, you know, is problematic. I mean, the government's spending hundreds of millions in building new prisons, including one in Kempville in a few years. And, you know, we need social housing to address these issues and help people, you know, be safe for themselves and others in the community. And we're just not making those kind of investments right now here in Ottawa or anywhere else across the province.
I'm running out of time here, but I want to know, is it a different situation in terms of the way it's being handled in the federal penitentiary scene as opposed to provincial?
Well, the federal side of things, they rolled out their vaccines earlier.
I thought so.
And I mean, they made the decision they weren't going to be releasing.
It was a priority.
People,
yeah.
And they decided at least we'll vaccinate them, and they haven't had cases in a number of weeks, right?
Have they had the same hesitancy?
There's been some hesitancy, particularly amongst racialized people in the system.
Again, we know
again
the history.
Systemic discrimination experience outside and inside prison walls, but. The vaccination rate right now is 80%, whereas in Ontario, it's like around 50% right now.
Boom. There's the proof right there. Justin, thank you. Appreciate the insights. It's eye-opening, to say the least.
All right. Take care.
You too. Justin Pichet, Associate Professor in the Department of Criminology at the University of Ottawa, clearly walks the walk and talks the talks, setting up that hotline and hearing firsthand from those on the other side. 11:20, quick break. And then coming up, you want to... adopt a golden retriever that has been saved in a rescue flight? We'll discuss that on the other side. News Talk 580 CFRA.
Lee Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA. Agree or disagree, we want to hear from you. Text us at 580-580. Please include your name and where you're texting from.
Well, 24 hours ago, we had to put down my family pet after 13 years. My sister and I went, and it was, as you can imagine, a tough scene, although it wasn't as hard as the first time I had a dog, so it was the first time I had to go through this. But I know the love firsthand of dogs, and now it's time to look for a rescue, right? We all say they're the best dogs because they love you because you saved them. Well, quite the scene at Pearson on the weekend. 30 golden retrievers, there were rescue dogs, came in on an Egypt Air jet from Cairo. Golden retrievers, what's going on here? Where are they from and what happened to them? Let's bring in Viva Tam. She's co-chair of Golden Rescue. Good morning.
Good morning, and I'm so sorry to hear about for a baby.
Mine was a golden doodle, so he was half a golden, and they are smart and loving, and like everyone knows, most dogs, they had nothing but joy to give us. I can't imagine what it's like to be part of a rescue group and what you must find with these dogs. First of all, where do they come from?
These Goldens who arrived came from Cairo, but we've rescued over 900 from Cairo and Istanbul.
All Goldens?
All Goldens.
Now, pardon me, yep. I don't mean to stereotype, but that's the last breed I would worry about being abused for obvious reasons.
Well, you know what? Exactly. When my husband and I went to the Sportsman Show many, many years ago, we saw a golden rescue booth, and we thought they were rescuing people, like they were, you know,
right,
you know,
exactly.
Trained for. And when we saw the booth, we thought that's what it was. And we went over, and the first question that so many people ask is, why do golden retrievers need rescuing?
And what did they answer?
Well, Well, you know, there's so many circumstances. Some of them are understandable, and you know, so you know, an owner dies, and where do they go? You know, or somebody develops allergies, or but there's you know, lots and lots of sad reasons. I mean, we just recently had someone who was moving to a new home, and I guess it was an apartment, and they didn't allow dogs, so he took his Golden to the vet and said, could you please euthanize him today because I can't take him with me. Well, fortunately, the vet called us and said, will you take him? And we said, absolutely. He was 10 years old and in absolute great health. And so he's in our program and he's got a brand new home.
How many are available for adoption right now?
Well, at any given time, there's probably somewhere around 20.
Wow.
But during the pandemic, we've been quite a bit slower, so we've been able to help a lot more international Goldens.
So where do they come from? You talked about Egypt, but how do you find them?
Well, we deal with four different shelters in Cairo, and we actually visited Cairo to, you know, check out their operations, do our due diligence, make sure that they were, you know, good, you know, and good to their all the animals there. But the situation over there is deplorable. Yeah. I mean, we brought in 30 Goldens last week. We're bringing in another 40 this week.
Wow.
We've brought in about 100 in the last month.
Unbelievable. Good on
you. It is.
I mean, it's very rewarding to see the final chapter when you're, you know, the families are meeting their adopted dogs. That being said, to get to that point must be heartbreaking for you.
Oh, it is. And when you see some of the conditions that these Goldens came in, I mean, there was one that was chained to a wall and intentionally set on fire. You know, and another, you know, another one, Gracie, whose back end was paralyzed, and we brought her in, and now she's got her own wheelchair for her back legs, and she is just running through the forest at top speed. These are things that, you know, the shelters over there, when they have 2,000-3,000 dogs in their shelter, they just can't offer them that kind of support and wellness. And so we bring them here, and now, for example, Gracie's got the best life ever, and she just she would have just withered away in the shelter.
How do you afford this?
Well, it's all fundraising. We are all entirely volunteer run. We don't have a single employed person, and we don't get any government assistance, so we have aggressive fundraising campaigns all the time. We have a lot of monthly donors. Right now we have our major fundraiser, which is our Wishbone Lottery, and we have an online 50-50 draw, so we're always actively fundraising, because it costs about $1,500 to get one Golden to our shores when they're overseas. And our domestic Goldens, you know, and I want to say that our domestic Goldens will always take precedence. We help whenever we can overseas, but we will never say no to a Canadian Golden first and foremost.
Viva, how do people help you? Where do they go?
www.goldenrescue.ca. There's all kinds of ways to donate and help, or buy Wishbone Lottery tickets, or go to our 50-50. You know, and we're always looking for volunteers and fosters and adopters. So you can find it all on our website. And we've got a very, very active and fabulous social media platforms.
Where do we find you? Just Golden Rescue on all platforms?
Yep. Perfect. On all the platforms. Yep.
GoldenRescue.ca.
That's it.
Viva, I salute you. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for bringing awareness to Golden Rescue and to Rescue specifically. And I hope your next fur baby is a Golden.
I would love that. And
or a Rescue.
Both, hopefully. I love my Goldens, but Rescues, I know that there are a lot of loving dogs out there that need homes. So.
And you know what? Sometimes when they come off the plane, you think that they shouldn't actually like humans, but they come out of their crates, and 2 seconds later, those tails are up and they're wagging. And you know what? They know that they've been rescued.
Yeah,
that's
no,
what you started off by saying. Yeah, they know it.
They do, and they live in the present moment, right?
Oh, they do.
Yeah, and I had
they're goofballs.
I had this discussion in the final moments yesterday with the vet as she was walking us through it and talk about, you know, talk about what we were about to experience and the love of a dog and how they live in the present and how we could all learn a thing or two about that unconditional love. Thank you, Viva. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
GoldenRescue.ca. 11:32, let's break for news. News Talk 580, CFRA.
On News Talk 580, CFRA. Share your opinion now. Text us at 580-580. Please include your name and where you're texting from.
Hey, we in Canada like to see ourselves as inclusive, right? And we see everyone as equal. Well, we know we got some work to do, whether it is concerning the Indigenous community, the Muslim community after that horrific crime in London, Ontario against a Canadian Muslim family. Of course, Black Lives Matter and the issues facing our Black community these days. Go through the list, the Jewish community, the LGBT community. You got to get them young because we learn bias. We're all born as somebody very accepting, and then we learn the biases. So let's talk about the kids' books that you read to your kids if you happen to be, I don't know, the average Canadian, like me. There was Snow White. There was Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Christopher Robin from Pooh Bear. What's the common denominator here? All the lead characters are white. There's something missing from our kids' books. We know it's changing. My next guest is helping to make that change. Her name is Rabia Kokar. She is a resource teacher with the GTA, and she's put together a summer reading list for families who want to fight Islamophobia. Good morning. Thanks for coming on.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Did my story about, you know, the characters resonate with you?
Yeah, totally. I think so many of the stories that we read often only have one type of or single representation. And I really like your point of, you know, that there is change coming.
Yeah.
And I think we all have to sort of mobilize together to make that change.
And I'm embarrassed to say I wouldn't know where to get a book to teach kids about about the Muslim community, about Islam, why a woman who practices wears a hijab. I wouldn't know where to begin. Mm-hmm. I apologize for that. I should know better. I, you know, as someone who is very much in favor of inclusion and equality, I'm guilty of not knowing where to buy that book.
Mm-hmm. I think you know, a lot of us face that, and we often don't know like where to start. And I think our sociopolitical context allows us to really like reach towards and build bridges to people who are doing the work. And it's not just about like leaning into them. We also have to do our work, but I think that there are so many opportunities for us to build bridges between people. And I think through that way, we can really like learn about each other. And that can really help us know where to start based on our context and, you know, our identities.
And you put together this list. I know you're a book nerd from going way back. So you love reading. Was it hard to find books in our country that would meet that? I mean, how deep do we go when it comes to books about the Muslim community?
Yeah, I think, you know, as a visible Muslim woman growing up, there were often not many books that really represented my everyday experiences. And if there were books, they were often written by people who were outsiders to the community. And so they were often just like a single story, like the same narrative of, you know, Muslim women needing to be saved or, you know, being oppressed. And so I think through the reading challenge, I really just wanted to counter those narratives and really, you know, do my research and to really bring forward books that just showed Muslims in everyday universal experiences, because I really feel like that's really the heart of building bridges of understanding, really when we can see ourselves in our everyday experiences. I think that builds our humanity with each other.
Absolutely. Hey, kids get to see themselves in the book, and then kids who aren't like the Muslim kid get to learn about the others. So let me ask you a question. What age group did you, in your list, what age group are you targeting?
So I'm an elementary teacher. So my, I guess my lens or my perspective was really primary, but also middle school. So a lot of the books that were curated were sort of like picture books, early chapter books, and some chapter books. So that was kind of my lens. But I do believe that, you know, I think all kids can read all types of books. So I feel like, you know, a picture book is just as valuable in kindergarten as it is in grade like 7 or 8. So I really, I feel like, you know, books you know, any type of books can really be expanded to really be for all types of kids of all ages.
Although I'd like to get to them earlier than grade 7. Kindergarten yes. is the way to do it, if not beforehand. These are books you can pick up. So mm-hmm. I've got a time for a couple of recommendations. What are your top three?
From the list?
Yeah. What would you pick for if there's a parent listening or a grandparent mm-hmm. and says, I want to introduce these books to my kids or grandkids?
Mm-hmm. Definitely Halal Hot Dogs.
Halal Hot Dogs.
Fatima's Great Outdoors. It's about a Muslim family going on a camping trip for the first time. And I think it really, you know, expands the idea of like who the outdoors is for.
Uh-huh.
And so I think that representation is important.
Okay.
What else would I say? They're also good. I would say Anina's Voice, which is really about building those inter-religious, intercultural, interfaith relationships. And I think it's so beautiful because it really shows solidarity within communities and how people just come together. So I think that's really important.
So that one's called Amina's Voice?
Yes.
Okay. And the other one you said was Fatima's Outdoor Adventure?
Great
Outdoors.
Yes, Great Outdoors. And okay. the first one was Halal Hot Dogs.
Halal
one
Hot Dogs.
More?
Yeah, sure.
I think I would say they're also difficult to choose from. I think I would say The Librarian of Basra, which is about a community helper and really like a community hero who saves books in her community because her library, the public library, which is a meeting place, is going to be destroyed because of the war. So she kind of makes a plan to bring all of the books to her home. And so I think that really shows us what like an active citizen and what a community helper looks like.
Oh, they're all great messages, and they're definitely all about inclusion, and I love that. And I think that if nothing else, people who are listening are going, I never thought of that. Maybe I should be buying a book that's a little different for my kids, since the world is changing in a good way.
Yes.
Appreciate it. Thanks for your time and your insights.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rabia Kokar, a resource teacher in the GTA, making a difference with getting to our kids young and showing them the beauty that of inclusion and diversity in our great country. 11:47, almost 11:48, News Talk 580, CFRA.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580, CFRA. Share your opinion now. Text us at 580-580. Please include your name and where you're texting from.
Hey, we have an important reminder now about what to do in an accident. Things are always evolving with technology and the like. Would you know if you got into a minor fender bender, would you know what to do? Would you pull over? Would you block the lane? Would you call 911? Would you do an accident report? Going to answer all those questions and more with the president and CEO of CAA North and Eastern Ontario, Mr. Jeff Walker. Hey there, Jeff.
Hey, Leslie. How are you?
I'm well. As I was researching for this, I would have got a lot of this quiz wrong.
You're right. You know, I think a lot of us have a version of this in our head from maybe 10 or 20 years ago.
Right.
But it's changed.
Yeah, it has. Okay, so what's the biggest change that has happened?
I think the biggest one is the whole issue of, the 911, obviously, if it's an emergency, you got to call 911. But the biggest change is, if it's not an emergency, that there's this mechanism called Collision Reporting Center Ottawa, in this case, that you're supposed to reach out to and report car crashes or accidents. And that the other big one is the $2,000 thing. So if you think it's more than $2,000 in terms of damage, you got to call the police.
A dent in the side of the car could be $2,000, right? So more cases than not, I would imagine you do call police.
Unfortunately, yes, and it is hard to judge, but the truth of it is, yeah. A lot of times, like if it's you know, a dent in the door, significant dent in the door, it's probably $2,000.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And you pull off to the side, right? And there was a time when, don't move, they want to see the accident scene.
Yeah, well, you don't have to do that. No, you can pull it over if it's safe. You move the vehicles from the roadway. The other cool part, and I guess technology is good at this, is you can take pictures.
Oh, right,
so
of course.
Before you remove it from the roadway, you and or if you're on your own yourself, but if you're with, you know, you crash into somebody else, you can take pictures and then move the car. You don't have to leave it there once you've taken the pictures, right?
It can be your own reconstruction unit.
Which is nice. Then you don't clogged the Queensway for 4 hours.
Right, exactly. Now, what's needed for, let's say, when I call CAA Insurance now, what do I need to make sure I have ready to go?
You just need to make sure the basic stuff, you know, your name, you know, driver's license number, address, et cetera, that for you. And then for, again, if there's someone else involved in it, you know, insurance info, but everybody has their insurance info. They should in their, you know, their glove box. So, you know, have that information with you when you're, you know, submitting it to the insurance company.
Okay. It's as simple as that. And again, the CAA, when do we call you or do we have to rely on the tow truck from, you know, that's sitting on the side of the overpass here?
Okay. Really, really, really important.
Please.
Call us. If you're a CAA member, call us. Okay. Because what we'll do is we'll adjudicate for you to tell you whether you need to use somebody else or not. But lots of times you can just use CAA in that situation. So do call us if you've got your card on you, or if you've downloaded the app. Phone number's right there. It's literally one click.
Yeah. I've used it a couple of times.
Yeah, and it's easy, right? Because we'll tell you, no, don't use us. You got to use somebody else. But most of the time, a lot of the times, it will be us that can help you out.
And if you don't know where you are, doesn't it have a GPS that allows you to figure it out too?
Oh yeah, we have all GPS.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's good. We have an app that's like an Uber thing.
Yeah.
So it actually lit us a little picture of our truck coming toward you.
That's what I meant. Yeah, I saw that. And again, if you're a CAA member, there's a discount, right, for the insurance, and whether it be car or house.
Absolutely. Members, I mean, I literally, we're in the middle of a contest, so I literally got an email this morning with 130 testimonials of members over the last, like, 3 months who've just saved, you know, $500, $300, $800, crazy money. If you're 10%, you know, it's 10% off automatically for car insurance if you're a member. If you've been a member 10 years, it's 20% off your car insurance. Mm. So it's not small money. It's actually significant.
And the MyPace, pay-as-you-go insurance option, that's something I would imagine with, you know, fewer people driving right now, that it's probably very popular?
It's awesome. That's what I have. So, like, I'm at home today.
Yeah.
I didn't pay a dollar in car insurance today
because I didn't
drive anywhere.
So how do you measure it?
Well, it has a little, it's like a USB thing that you plug in. It's called an OBD port, and it gets plugged in. And so it just tracks when you're moving and how many kilometers you're driving.
Yeah.
And then it charges you per 1,000 kilometers. So every time you click over it, it has an automatic debit from your credit card or your bank account to pay for the next 1,000.
The CAA's come a long way. So when you used to go downtown, pick up the maps and go to sandbanks and you would unfold them in your car, you guys have really grown and taken the industry by storm.
Well, we got Bike Assist now, too. Eh?
Oh,
we
what's
launched
that?
Bike Assist this summer.
Yeah.
So for $30, you can get a membership that covers you and your bike. So you're driving or you're on your bike, you're in Gatineau Park, you know, you have a flat, whatever.
Okay.
Call us up. We take care of it. We'll either come and pump it up or we'll bring you home. $30.
What if I'm just tired, not a flat tire? Gatineau Park has quite the incline.
Come on, Leslie. You can do it, man. I've seen you. You look pretty fit.
Jeff Walker, good dodge there. Appreciate it. President and CEO of CAA North and Eastern Ontario, and always fun to talk to. Thank you, Jeff. 11:59, that's it for today. Thanks for joining us. Don't go anywhere. Evan Solomon after the news. Next, News Talk 580 CFRA.
You're listening to News Talk 580 CFRA, Ottawa's home for breaking news.